Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. Thanks for joining us, and remember to subscribe for free on your favorite platform. My guest today is Michelle Petrowski, a certified financial planner and certified divorce financial analyst. A big supporter of the economic empowerment of women and families, she believes that when women have more money, they have more choices. More choices afford them the opportunity and responsibility to be leaders in their families and communities and positively impact our world. As the founder of financial planning and wealth management firm Being in Abundance and founder of Being Mindful in Divorce, she is focused on helping purpose-driven single, divorced, and widowed women create financial stability and wealth. Servant leadership and financial literacy are important aspects of Michelle's work. Over the years, she has volunteered with organizations like Savvy Ladies in New York, a financial education nonprofit, and Fresh Start Women's Foundation in Phoenix, which helps women achieve and sustain economic self-sufficiency. She has also served on the board of directors for the Financial Planning Association in New York and Greater Phoenix. She is an active member of the Maricopa Association of Family Mediators in Arizona and Rotary International, one of the largest service organizations in the world. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you for having me, Andrea.
You became a certified financial analyst and certified divorce financial analyst over 15 years ago after a successful career in tech. Can you tell us what led you to that?
Oh, gosh. You know, I have to be honest, I always loved being in tech and I never thought I would leave. And I was very blessed to have a lot of opportunities, including working 14 years at home, completely remote, so I was able to raise my kids. But working for a big organization like Chase, we just had so many mergers over the years. And with each merger came a different culture change. The last one was with Bank One, and we really moved from a place of delivering things that were sustainable and helpful for our business partners to really just putting projects on hold one after another, doing a phase. And it really became difficult for me to continue working in that environment. I felt like I really wasn't making a difference, and it started to challenge my contribution to the world and make me think a little bit differently, like I wanted to do more. So when my husband, who also worked at Chase at the time, was leaving to go to a spinoff, we needed to go see a financial planner, and we spoke with her. And when we left, my husband at the time said to me, you know, you're just as smart as her or smarter, and I think you could do this. I really kind of was always the CFO of our family, if you will. And so that really kind of propelled me towards becoming a financial planner. And then when I became a planner and I was just starting out, my husband said to me, oh, I guess you can't divorce me now because now you don't make the kind of money you used to make before. Honestly, I was just hanging on until my youngest son was 18 years old. I had about 6 years left. But it said to me, like, shoot, I really got to get my stuff together because this is something I'm going to be facing. My husband then announced he wanted a divorce, and now he wanted to value my business. Just to take a step back, we had a mediator. It was going to cost us $1,800. We had come to the table. We worked everything out. We were supposed to have the final meeting for us to sign everything. He totally ghosts the mediator. And so now at this point, he has a girlfriend. His father has said, hey, you know, I think you guys can get a better deal and I'll fund your attorney costs. And now all of a sudden we go from $1,800 to like $200,000 in lost family wealth for game playing over the next like almost 2 years. After that, I had to move across the country with my daughter for some medical reasons and leave my son behind because that became another game. I really felt like getting the Certified Divorce Financial Analyst designation would help me to help other women because even though I was a certified financial planner, honestly, I got totally screwed. I had given up maintenance and child support that had already been negotiated in light of extra assets because I was moving. Inevitably, I moved. He refused to sell the house and started playing games. I had to take him to court for contempt. It left me with a feeling of like, if that happened to me and I'm smart and educated and I'm a planner, like who else is this happening to and how can I make a difference in this space?
While the details are unique to you, that situation is one I have heard other women share. Thank you for sharing that personal element to let people know not just that you have the professional competency, but you have been through something that allows you to identify with the clients who come to you for advice.
When you're working with someone and there is that connection and you can see at the end that you've helped them create a better outcome, it really is satisfying. For me personally, my spirituality is really important, and that really kind of blossomed during my divorce. It makes me feel like God is using something, turning that pain into purpose.
I want to make sure listeners understand what exactly a certified financial analyst and a certified divorce financial analyst are.
As a certified financial planner, we really look at people from a holistic point of view. We have to kind of see the whole picture before we can even get into the investments. So we're really looking at all those pieces of your financial life, cash flow, debt management. What are your employee benefits? Things like risk management would mean, do you have disability insurance at work? Are you taking advantage of that long and short term? Why is that important? Retirement planning, what types of plans are available to you? Are you maximizing them? Traditional Roth, IRA, 401k, et cetera. Looking at tax planning, what are things that we can do now or maybe in the future to help offset that tax burden? Because the less we're paying to the government, the more we get to keep in our pocket. Estate planning, and then investments. So like once we know all those pieces, then you can really make recommendations of where somebody should be invested, rather than someone coming to you and saying, you know, you're looking at how much somebody makes and saying, oh, this is great. You know what? You can save $5,000 a month and I'm going to put you in these mutual funds. And I have this great whole life insurance policy that would be workable. And I have this annuity, and people are jumping to investments first in products rather than looking at that big picture. I think one distinction also being a certified financial planner is that as part of our ethics, if you will, we're actually required to always be acting as a fiduciary, always putting best interest of the client ahead of myself. The other thing for me personally is I'm also a fee-only planner. I'm not selling you insurance. I might make a recommendation that you need insurance. You might ask me for a referral to somebody and I could introduce you to some folks I know, but I'm not getting any kind of referral fee from that person and I'm not making commission on that sale. You know, likewise, like an annuity or even like an estate planning, you know, if I'm sending you to an estate planning attorney. So I can really kind of take that step back and say, best I can, I'm being unbiased in how I'm trying to help you. Then a certified divorce financial analyst, for me being a CFP, I almost feel like it's the next level of planning. It's like financial planning, but on steroids. And that's because the planning software we use is really cool. Instead of looking at two people in a combined household, you can now separate them into two different households. So when you're creating that settlement, you have the ability to look at it on before and an after tax basis. You're able to look at the cash flow and the net worth of both people individually, laying in Social Security, Medicare, inflation, all their expenses. And then you could go out 20, 30 years into the future to help that person have an idea of how those different choices they're making are actually going to impact them long-term. Because typically, like let's say you were going to an attorney, for example, what are they doing? They're looking at the assets. They're trying to understand before and after tax, but they don't have software helping them make those decisions. And they can't tell you anything about cash flow and net worth. They're just saying 50-50-50 or, you know, 60-40 or whatever they decide. And then that's what you get. On paper, that looks okay, but how do you really know? Someone might have an asset that's, you know, generating income, for example, and somebody else doesn't, and that's going to make a big difference in the long run. So you want to be able to see that long-range picture so that we can then make informed decisions during that negotiation process. So both parties are really going to be okay.
That's so important. And I'm glad you mentioned the fact that you're a fiduciary, because a lot of people aren't aware of that option. And it does make a world of difference. You work for the client. You're not working for some big company trying to sell a particular product.
One thing which is really difficult in today's environment is, although you're a CFP and we're required to act as a fiduciary when we're giving financial advice, there are many CFPs that also sell products or work for companies that have like proprietary products or mutual funds. And it really puts those folks like between a rock and a hard place, because how can they really say or act in the best interest if their income is being tied to their recommendation? So even though somebody is a CFP, you probably want to ask them, you know, do you sell products? Are you getting paid on commission as well? And then, you know, use that combination of information to make your decision from there.
Fantastic advice. Really, really good advice. When somebody decides to divorce, it's usually because they've already gone through a significant period of time, often years, recognizing that their marriage isn't healthy anymore. They've tried to work things out, hoping for change, but it hasn't done any good. And so then they have the realization that the harm of staying in an irretrievably broken marriage would cause even greater harm. divorce happens at all ages. And in fact, we're seeing an increase of what's called gray divorces, meaning divorces among people in their 50s and older. However, particularly women often aren't aware of the financial aspects of divorce and how to best prepare and protect themselves. And in a LinkedIn post a while back, you said that divorce is one of the single most impactful financial decisions we can make in our lives with a long-term impact.
Yes, I gotta be honest. I really believe that divorce is a retirement crisis for women. It creates poverty for children. And I believe that no one is really paying attention to this. And it's not just a familial problem. It's actually a community problem. When somebody goes into poverty and they have to use community services, we're all paying for that. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but I think that we need to pay a little more attention to that. And I think we need to do a little overhaul of the divorce process to make sure that we have a financial person that is involved at the division of assets so that we can make sure that there's a more equitable split. And we're really acknowledging the economic contribution that that person made when they stayed at home and what they lost. And although most states say that they're going to consider these factors, I live in Arizona and I see it all the time. Women get divorced and you have a spouse that's making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. Okay, go work at Target. Go work at Target? She's been home raising those kids for how many years? I've had men tell me, oh, I own, you know, gas stations. I own, you know, car dealerships, whatever. She didn't do anything. Oh, I'll give her 20%. Really? She was your chief operating officer. Who was running the household when you went to work every day? I'd love to know, sir, because you wouldn't have built that business if it wasn't for her. Those clients, I send them to other people because I don't have any tolerance for that. And I feel like those folks are really trying to use the mediation process to get over on their spouse and avoid discovery. When people get divorced, it's almost like going through an economic depression. And now there are children involved. Little attention is really paid to the correlation between marriage and poverty in comparison to when we think about the reaction about the decrease in the national economy. When Americans' economic productivity dropped by 2.1% in 1981 to 1982, we called it a recession. And then when the economy contracted 30.5% or 203 million to 141 million from 1929 to 1933 was called the Great Depression. Yet each year and every year for the past 27 years, over 1 million children have experienced divorce in their family with an associated reduction in family income that ranges anywhere from 28 to 42%. And nobody sees this as a crisis. It blows my mind. They say the average first divorce is at 30 years old. Average length of marriage is 8 years. Women are more likely, like 66%, to file first. If you're thinking of divorce, you need to think about this really heavily because women suffer so much more and in such more significant ways financially than men do after divorce. One study showed that the standard of living for women can drop almost 50%. For men, it's about 20%. Another study found that 75% of all women who apply for welfare benefits do so specifically because of a disrupted marriage. 44% of women fall in poverty after divorce. Mothers who remain married are almost 3 times more likely to avoid poverty than those that choose divorce. Child support and alimony, maybe they help, but certainly not preventing these women from suffering tremendous economic hardships when they have children.
We're not suggesting here that people stay in a marriage that's not working. They need to create a support system to protect themselves and their children if they have children post-divorce.
Yes, exactly. I had actually a woman, when I was going through my divorce, hand me a card that I should contact the Coalition for Domestic Violence. And I was like, what? And it wasn't really until she gave me that card and I thought about it that I realized, yeah, I was experiencing emotional and financial abuse in my marriage. So yes, don't stay if there's something bad going on. But you have to be really smart about it if you're planning to get divorced and plan ahead.
I know we're not going to be dispensing any legal advice today, but given your line of work, can you tell us what different divorce options exist? There's contested divorce, uncontested divorce, and so forth.
The highest level is contested and uncontested. So contested is like the two of you can't really agree about things, maybe about alimony, custody, child support, how we're going to divide the property, you know, other things that are important. It usually takes longer. It's more expensive. This is, I think, the type of divorce when people think they have to run out and get an attorney and they're really preparing for potential litigation. Quite honestly, I really don't think this should be the first choice if you're thinking about divorce. There are alternate divorce resolution models. Even if you think that you're in a relationship with a high conflict person, I wouldn't jump to that immediately. I think you start to have some delicate conversations. What could you potentially agree upon or not agree upon first before jumping there? Because in many times it could just cost so much more. I mean, stress-wise, money-wise, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that way because you've put the person on the defensive. If you could work it out between the two of you, the attorney should almost be the last person because you want to bring them what you guys think is fair. Speak with a financial person to figure out if it's really workable and it looks equitable for both of you in the long term. You can have something called a settlement conference. Your attorney will be there with you. They're usually speaking on your behalf. There's also facilitated mediation. And the mediator is usually not an attorney. And they're really trained to kind of walk you through the options. There's also transformative. And in this case, the mediator's goal is really just try to empower you to both recognize the options that are available and kind of just manage that conflict within the conversation. Now, there's also another type of uncontested called collaborative divorce. Personally, I think it's awesome. I think it should almost be required for everyone, to be honest. And you each have your own attorney, and there's a communication specialist, and then there's a financial person. And so the financial person is really a neutral, helping the parties, as is the communication specialist. What's really great about collaborative is that everyone is signing an agreement to say that they are committed to the outcome. And what I found, too, is that because you're engaging in this type of process, the attorneys are going to hold their clients accountable. They're not going to allow them to do that game playing. And so it really is a process that I think works to benefit the family.
What are some of the different financial considerations people at different ages should keep in mind when divorcing?
I think, you know, younger couples who are really starting, let's just say maybe with equal assets, or even if they're not, if there aren't children involved, they really have the greatest chance, I think, of having a successful financial future after the divorce. So I think there's a lot less for them to be concerned about. When we now add children in the mix, I think they need to be thinking about, will the working spouse have disability insurance? How do we ensure they have disability insurance? What are the life insurance options that we might discuss to cover any alimony and child support owed in the future? Because what if something happened to that person? What if they were unable to work? This is going to impact the whole family unit, even though they're not living together under the same roof. Also, the life insurance for the same reason. We have to really be thoughtful. And when we're talking about later marriages after 50 and gray divorce, at this point, we might have spent a lifetime building this life together. And we were kind of like business partners. And now we're going into this phase that we're going to be calling retirement. And we thought we were going to be sharing in this. So we've been accruing assets. When we have this breakup, honestly, it's like a business breaking up. And when one person walks away, especially the less moneyed spouse with less assets, and they only have X amount of years, how are they going to make up that time? Time's not on their side. Even if they were able to go back and get a decent job, they're only going to have, what, 10, 15 years, whatever the case is, to save. So it is really discouraging, I think, for especially women or anyone who's thinking about a divorce later in life. This is where the CDFA can really help. There are pensions that might need to be divided, 401ks. I just worked with a couple actually recently. They were close to their 80s. She was taking her pension. He was taking his Social Security, and they had a significant amount of retirement assets, and they owned the house outright. But the husband was very upset because the wife wanted the divorce. She was having a lot of health issues, and she felt for the marriage to continue, actually, it was going to just put her more at risk. You know, she felt like she needed to walk away at this point because she really didn't have many years left. And he was hurt, and I could understand his hurt completely. But out of reaction to that, he told her, you know, if you want a divorce, you can't have the house and I can't buy you out. And you're basically going to have to walk away with nothing, which she was kind of willing to do. But I also believe that he believed that he couldn't afford to do those things. He really thought like he was going to be jeopardized, but she's the one that wanted the divorce. But after doing the analysis, what we really came up with was that he could still keep the house, he could buy her out, and she could buy her own house. And it was surprising to him and to her. And I think he was so surprised by it that he said to her, you know what, you stay in the house. She was like, I can actually stay, which is what she wanted all along because she picked out the house, she decorated the house, she raised the children there. And it meant so much more to her, like she really wanted that house. It was wonderful because now that he realized he was going to be okay financially, he wanted a fresh start. And then she was able to stay there. you know, there was a little concern about the pension, but I said to him, you came to me saying that you wanted an equitable split based on net worth and cash flow. Your Social Security is significantly higher than hers because she was not able to give into Social Security because of her pension. So we have to think of them as equal streams of income. It's fine. She could give you half of that every month, or there could be a buyout, but you're going to have to then give her assets to make up for that lost income stream that she has every month to make it equitable for both of you. And so I was able to demonstrate that with the software. They were able to come to an agreement where they could both be secure and they could both have their own place and also know that they're not going to run out of money and they're going to be just fine.
A lot of folks do factor in Social Security when it comes to their later years. Any thoughts on that?
So like I would say, even if I wasn't talking to someone going through a divorce, my suggestion, even for myself and my own planning, is let's just leave it out and see what it looks like. If you get it, it's kind of like icing on the cake, if you will. We know it'll be better. So it's better to be conservative. If folks are getting divorced and we know that they will be receiving Social Security soon, like in the next year, or they're already taking it, we're definitely put it in. But around Social Security in general, when we think about it with marriage and divorce, the way the laws are written now, the magic number is really 10. So the 10 years that you're married consecutively makes you eligible for a Social Security or a survivor benefit based on the earnings record of yourself or your ex-spouse, whichever is higher. So if you're within a year or two or even three of Social Security and you're thinking of divorce and it's not a dire situation where, you know, it's an abusive situation, I would say wait the 10 years. Do the best you can to prepare yourself for when the moment comes. And that could also include potential going to a counselor. You know, I wouldn't omit that if you haven't tried it, or if you have, you know, and it didn't work with the two of you, there's no reason you can't go for counseling for yourself. That 10 years could make a difference for you if you're that close to retirement and you might get that. So how that kind of goes is under the rules, if you're married for 10 years or more consecutively and your spouse is already collecting, you can collect the higher of 50% of your spouse's full Social Security benefit when you're 62, or 100% of your own benefit, even if your spouse remarries. So it doesn't matter if they remarried somebody. But if your spouse is not already claiming, then there's a special rule. So if you've been divorced for 2 years or longer, and you're at least 62, and your ex-spouse is eligible for a Social Security retirement or a disability benefit, you could potentially be entitled to that as well, the higher of his 50% of his or hers versus your own, even if they're not collecting. One of the things, though, you have to be careful is that you have to be usually unmarried when claiming the benefit on your ex-spouse's record. But there are like some rules around remarrying. If you remarried before you're 60 and you're still married, you're not eligible to claim that benefit on your ex-spouse's record, even if you're a survivor or a widow, because you're in another marriage. So you're considered a spouse for somebody else. Now, if that person passes away and then your marriage ends, you could be re-eligible under your ex-spouse's record, as well as the next ex-spouse or the person that died. So you might have more options. The other one is if you remarry after 60, you may be able to use the Social Security claiming strategy that's based on your circumstances. My mom actually had a friend. She had gotten divorced. Her ex-spouse died. She was over 60 when she remarried. She was like almost 70. So she collected a survivor benefit, which was 100%. So your survivor benefit's 100%. So she was able to get 100% of her ex-spouse who passed away Social Security. It was higher than hers. And then she got remarried when she was 70. And she was able to still keep that benefit under the previous spouse that had passed away.
What role does the state you live in have on how assets are classified?
Again, it's not legal advice, but in general, property is either community property, depending on your state laws, or there are equitable distribution states. There are 9 community property states. I live in one of them here in Arizona. And then we really start with the supposition that like income, assets, and debts are all going to be divided equally 50-50, that they belong to both parties. So even if you're the stay-at-home parent, you're entitled to everything that's been earned, owned, and owed during the marriage. Arizona has a unique nuance, and a lot of states do as well. In our case, although we're community property and we're starting at 50-50, our statute says that it should be equitable. So someone could get more than 50 or less, you know, depending on the situation. And again, working with a planner kind of helps you figure that out. Also with community property, like let's say I was going to buy a home. This actually happened to me. So I got divorced in New York. My divorce wasn't signed yet. I moved to Arizona with my daughter, I went to buy a house. And so even though I was getting divorced in New York, I live now in a community property state. So that house was going to become half my spouse's. I had to have him sign a quitclaim deed to say that even though I was married, I was allowed to own that property as a separate person, as a single woman. And it was really interesting. He actually, when my realtor called him to tell him this, he kind of was pulling this card like, oh, well, no, I'm getting half that house. And I told her, you be really clear with him. If he says that, you tell him, well, she said she's walking away from the deal if you say that. I'll let her know. We'll find her another house once the divorce is signed. I'm sure it'll be in the next 60 days. And then he called her back and said, okay, fine, I'll sign the deed. This is different than in an equitable distribution state, where if I was buying the second house and I was still like embroiled in this divorce, it hadn't been signed yet, and I had some money, I could technically go buy my own house. They would give me a mortgage, and it wouldn't say Michelle as a single woman that I would need this quitclaim deed to give me like permission to do so.
We've been talking about when people divorce because the marriage is no longer positive, they're not getting along, there's abuse involved. But I've been hearing of situations where a couple may look at divorce as a way of managing healthcare costs, and that's really sad. Can you talk about what a medical divorce is and what the considerations should be when deciding whether or not to pursue that?
Gosh, the cost of healthcare is skyrocketing, and it's not just our premiums, right? It's that long-term care. So you might have a spouse, maybe they have Alzheimer's, maybe they have dementia. You need someone to come in the house to care for them. Maybe they need to go to a nursing home, or maybe you have a child with special needs. So these are really the two situations that maybe a medical divorce would come into play due to those costs. It's really the kind of thing where you're making a conscious decision as a couple to transfer the majority of the household assets either to the healthy spouse that they sometimes call the community spouse or to the parent that's not going to have custody of the child. The assets then would not be included in the income and the countable assets either for the ill spouse, because I moved them away and gave them to the healthy spouse, or to the custodial parent that has the special needs child. We want to like reduce their income. Now, if you're in a community property state, things are supposed to be divided 50-50. So if you're in Arizona, where maybe there's that nuance where it doesn't have to be 50-50, maybe you could transfer more of it to one spouse to another. But I would think in an equitable distribution state, you'd probably have a better chance of that getting through the courts for that reason. One of the things I did read was that medical divorce really isn't a worthwhile strategy for couples that have less than $500,000 in assets. And so from what I read, this has to do with like the 1988 enactment of the spousal impoverishment provisions by the federal government. And so this really allows the non-ill or the community spouse to keep a higher level of assets and income than the Medicaid applicant. And I guess in the past, that really wasn't the case. But some of the other things that you might want to just think about, so I mentioned like, are you in a community property state? There's also, you want to ask like, will Medicaid include the community spouse's IRA in the six spouse's asset limit, you know, like if you stay together. If it's going to contribute towards the limit, then maybe it is something that you need to be concerned about. Or if you stay married, most likely you're going to have to spend down some of the assets that you have to meet the Medicaid limits. I would say you really want to talk to somebody about this. This isn't something that you just want to say, oh yeah, this really sounds great, we should do this. There are attorneys that specialize in this kind of thing. I would say a Medicaid planning attorney is probably who you're looking for.
But if somebody is really considering divorce because they feel they cannot stay in this relationship any longer, but it isn't an acute situation where their mental or physical safety is right now at risk, or their children's or their companion animals' lives are at risk, what are some preparatory financial tasks you would recommend that, let's say, a woman undertakes? What advice could you give somebody? And how long would all of these things maybe take?
In general, I would say, if you're thinking about divorce and you have debt in your marriage, come up with a plan with your spouse to pay that off, because that it'd be great to take that off the table from the beginning. It's one less thing to argue about and a burden for either one of you to take on. I would say also collecting and copying documents, receipts for large items. Once you say you're going to get a divorce, things will start to disappear super quickly. 3 to 5 years of tax returns, full tax returns, not just the 1040. You want all the schedules. If you have access to bank account information, you're printing out bank accounts, savings accounts, 401k statements, IRAs, anything you can get your hands on. I would put it on a thumb drive, give it to a friend. I would not keep it at your house. Also, receipts for large things. Okay, we bought a boat, we got a car. You might have to go back and try to reconstruct the lifestyle you had because all of a sudden this person says they have no money and they owned a business that said they made $20,000 a year. Okay, well then how did we afford that $80,000 boat last year if you only really made $100,000 a year? An attorney told me years ago to check the air conditioning vents, the heating vents, and to drop ceiling tiles in your basement, that spouses hide money in those places. And I had told this to my best friend who's going through a divorce, and I'll just say she was surprised by what she found.
Wow.
Yeah. I would say change passwords on your phone, on your computer, get a safe deposit box, have your mail sent to your friend's house. Start to build an emergency fund, right? The more money you have in your own name, the less there is to fight about later and or kind of finance, right? So that you can hire a professional to help you.
That's a huge point.
Set up your own bank accounts if you don't already have one. If it's a contentious situation, have that mail sent to another location. Start then think about healthcare. That's expensive. How are you going to handle that? Marketplace, check out your state Medicaid requirements. Maybe you're eligible for that. There's COBRA, usually up to 36 months, but honestly, out of those three, it's usually the most expensive. Credit scores are so important. People don't realize that it could impact your ability to get a job, to rent a house, to get utilities in your own name. What does your credit score look like now? If it's not good, I would start working on it because in many cases, it's going to plummet after you get divorced. You want to get it up as best you can now. You know, if you have a high balance on one card and it's your own debt, maybe you take out a second card and you shift some of that so that you get your utilization below 30%. Oh gosh, this is a big thing. A lot of women specifically are authorized users on their husband's accounts and they don't realize they really don't have a credit card in their own name. You need to get them in your own name. And when you fill out the paperwork, you potentially, when they say income, you could put household income down. So you might want to think about that. You might also want to check your spouse's credit. And I say this particularly if you're in a community property state, because in our state, if my spouse has $100,000 in credit card debt that I don't know about and we get divorced, I'm responsible for half of that. And it doesn't matter if my divorce decree says that my husband is going to take it all on. Credit law is not the same as divorce law. That creditor can come after me afterwards for 50% of it. And not that it's going to get you off the hook, but you could put a clause in your agreement, which you should do anyway, even if you don't know about the debt, that says that if the other person like really isn't doing what they need to do on that, or if you have to pay off the debt, you can take them back to court at their cost. They're going to have to pay for your attorney so you can get that money back. I would also say, let's see, make a budget. If we separate and I got to go get my own apartment or vice versa, what's it going to look like? And then you also need a post-divorce budget. And then I was going to say, just lastly, think about some of the things with the kids. What are those expenses? Not just the ones now, but the future. What happens if the kid needs a car, cell phone? How are we going to pay for those trips to college to check out the schools? Who's going to pay for those like special classes? Like if they're in advanced classes, right, in junior, senior year, how are all those little details going to be worked out?
In a LinkedIn post, you recently talked about creating margin, which you describe as the breathing room in our finances that give us options and freedom.
When I was a kid, my grandfather, I mean, literally, I was 14 years old working for our family business, and I made $20 on a Saturday. So my grandfather explained this to me. And what he said was, first, he asked me how I was going to spend my $20. So he's taught me about the envelope system. And then he said, I want to teach you about margin. He said, every time you get a raise, you don't increase your lifestyle at the same rate that your income increases. I want to get a 10% raise. Maybe I'm going to keep 2 in my personal spending, but I'm going to save 8. And so it was a really good concept because I don't think a lot of people talk about that. You just, you know, you get a raise, you spend it. You get a bonus, you spend it.
Lifestyle creep.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, having that emergency fund is less likely to get you in credit card debt. When you get those raises and bonuses, being intentional can help us to create that margin. When we're younger and we don't have children yet or a house or those kinds of responsibilities, front loading our retirement when we have less expenses can also help create that margin. That was really big for me in my marriage too, was to have that money later because I couldn't save at the same rate when I had kids. And it helped to keep us out of debt. One of the clients I was working with, she had a high amount of credit card debt. Seek a debt management program. I am not talking about a debt settlement program. and I can't think of the name of the foundation right now. It's like the National Foundation of Credit Counseling or something like that, to find a debt management company that does credit counseling, not for profit. They can help negotiate a deal for you with different creditors where you're paying maybe 50% of the debt and then you owe 0% interest and you don't have to go delinquent and they'll start making payments immediately. You could be saving tens of thousands of dollars. And now that you have that extra cash flow in your budget, now you can start to create that margin. Save ahead for those things that you know that you're going to be spending money on. Travel, clothes, things for your kids, or build your emergency fund if you don't have one.
Let's take a couple of steps back and say that there's a couple, they've been together, they're in love, they want to formalize their relationship and get legally married. What is your advice on setting up a prenuptial agreement? Some people are strongly opposed since they believe it commodifies a union that's created out of love. So what are your thoughts on prenups, especially for women who may want children or who take on other support or caretaking roles during the marriage that mean they either won't or have very limited work outside the home? And by work, I mean paying work. Obviously, being a homemaker, being a parent, that is invaluable work.
Honestly, I always was against a prenup like years ago. I just thought it sounded so horrible. Having been through a divorce myself and thinking I had been smart about certain things, like when I was married to my ex-husband, I owned a house before we were married. I assumed that once we got married, that it would still be my separate property because I was very careful to pay for it from my own account and all that kind of stuff. But I really believed that when we got divorced, that I was able to prove that I owned it ahead of time and that at least my down payment would be returned to me if nothing else. Wasn't really the case. So I think having something is really important. So even if you don't want to call it a prenuptial agreement and go to an attorney, maybe you just do something informally between the two of you. You create, I don't know, a domestic partnership agreement. I would have one sheet that shows everything both of you brought to the marriage. So in my case, I would have listed that I owned a home. I would have put that I put $40,000 on it and that we both agree that that will come off the top in the future of any home that we sell before, you know, anything is split. If you're going to stay home and have children, talk about that. Whoever stays home is going to be compensated in some way. So what does that compensation look like? Maybe you're going to max out a contribution to their spousal IRA every year in acknowledgement of non-moneyed contribution that they're making to the household. They're giving up giving into their 401k and having Social Security benefits and or having a pension they're paying into. So, you know, talk about those kinds of things. Maybe you even go as far as to say, for every year of marriage, there'll be X in spousal support. But be specific, list those things, acknowledge the fact that if one spouse stays home, there is an understanding that there will be spousal maintenance, that there's an understanding that the education will also be paid for the children, even if it's not required for your state. I'd sign it and have it notarized by someone at the bank. Even if it's unofficial, you've acknowledged that you have an agreement. You could bring that to court to say, hey, we had a conversation about this. This person is now saying no, but we clearly discussed it.
That's fantastic advice. And it gets around the he said, she said.
Yeah. Or somebody's parent gives a very large wedding gift and the intention is that that's going to be used for home. And if you got divorced, the parent's going to want the money back or something. Like, write that down. If someone refuses to have that level of conversation with you and put it in writing and have some random person at the bank sign it, that would be a huge red flag to me.
Do you have any suggestions for handling the emotional aspects of divorce?
One of the biggest things is community. You need to talk with people, possibly a therapist or a counselor if you don't already have one. Maybe joining a group with other people who are getting divorced. There's a program called Divorce Care. There's something called Second Saturday. You need to have people with you who are walking the same walk as you.
How can people get in touch if they'd like to set up a consultation or work with you?
I do have on my website, on the contact page, Being in Abundance, that you can schedule like a 20-minute financial next steps conversation, and we can just talk about what's currently going on, whether it's pre-divorce, during divorce, or post-divorce, whether it's around credit, you're looking for long-term planning, you have an executive comp, whatever the case is, to kind of see what is the best way that we can work together.
Michelle, thanks so much for having taken the time today.
Oh, you're so welcome.